for different occasions. A blue dress for intuition. The gray shirt and maroon slacks. For making strong statements. The navy pullover. And the woolen skirt. For discovering mystery. She thinks of what she wore on a similar occasion.
Thank you, David Byrne. That, of course, is off the knee place. This is Sebastian Matthews, and I'm here with Jeff Davis for another episode or
adventure
with wordplay. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
Good, Sebastian. How about you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Well, today we have an interesting show, mostly some 2002 recording of Galway Canal up at the Breadloaf Writers Conference.
Right.
And we also have a few other, hopefully a few other things to mix in, music,
yes,
and poetry.
Odds and ends.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you had some info about Jonathan Williams that we were just listening to kind of strangely last week's show.
Yeah, yeah. Our automation here seems to be like an hour ahead instead of being an hour behind, which is what it usually is. So we were hearing a little bit of Jonathan Williams, and that show is now archived permanently on the web at pensound.edu, I believe it is. But you can check our blog, wordplayradio.blogspot.com, to get the actual URL and a functioning link to
good.
It.
Well, it was beautiful to hear, sad to hear his voice, knowing that he's just passed away.
Yeah.
Great poems. And
a good reading. He was really still on top of his game, you know, in 2005.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The audience was into it.
And the audience was in. It was a great crowd that night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains, and we're doing wordplay. And let's begin with the Galway Canal. He's coming to town soon, which we'll be talking about with a bunch of other poets in the end of the month for the Word Fest.
That's right, Word Fest.
Yeah. He's going to be reading with Rick Chess and UNCA. But we will talk about that at the halftime. And I'm still in the final four mode here.
And too bad.
Sorry,
too
UNCA.
Bad, I know.
UNC, you guys. They made a push.
They made a push. Yep. Almost came back.
Okay. Galway Canal, 2002, Breadloaf Writers' Conference.
Good afternoon. The first time I came to the Breadloaf campus was in 1951. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. I only came up here because I was down in Middlebury trying to learn French. I only came up here to look at it, and also I went up to Ripton, hearing that Robert Frost was living there. I went up to Ripton, and in the old style Vermont way, where you didn't telephone to see if you could come to visit, you just pull up in front of the house and sort of sit there. Indeed, a woman came out of the house. That was Kay, who was looking after Frost, and I explained that I was just came up to see if I could talk with Robert Frost, and she said, "Well, I think he would like to talk to you. So just wait around 20 minutes. He'll be down from his cabin." And in about 20 minutes, he came down from his cabin, and we spent the afternoon together. And I felt, elated when I left. He had even asked me, did I happen to have a poem of my own with me? And it just so happened I had a poem of my own with me. And he made some nice comments about it. And then I felt kind of, you know, I was, how old I was then, but about 20-something, one or two. And anyway, I felt kind of anointed into the world of letters by that visit, and so I've been here quite a number of times since. But I thought I'd like to read a poem I wrote about Frost, even though it lacks the generosity of spirit that it would have if I wrote it now. This guy trying to be smart or something. Why do you talk so much, Robert Frost? One day I drove up to Ripton to ask. I stayed the whole day and never got the chance to put the question. I drove off at dusk, worn out and aching in both ears. Robert Frost, were you shy as a boy? Do you go on making up for some long period of solitude? Is it that talk doesn't have to be metered and rhymed, or is talk distracting from something worse? And I'm not going to read you the whole poem, but the next section I'll read, if I were writing this today, I don't know if I could write it as well. Kennedy's inauguration was the first inauguration to be televised in that new technology, and so everybody was watching. I saw you once on the TV, unsteady, and that was also the first time a poet had been asked to give an inaugural poem. I saw you once on the TV, unsteady at the lectern, the flimsy white leaf of hair standing straight up in the wind, among top hats, old farmer and son of worse winters than this, stopped in the first dazzle of the District of Columbia, suddenly having to pay for the cheap onion skin, the worn-out ribbon, the eyes wrecked from writing poems for us, stopped, lonely before millions, the paper jumping in your grip. And as the presidents also on the platform began flashing nervously their presidential smiles for the harmless old guy, and poets watching on the TV started thinking, well, that's the end of that tradition. And the managers of the event said, boys, this is it. This son of a bitch poet is going to croak. Putting the paper aside, you drew forth from your great faithful heart the poem. Now, I'm going to read a poem for a poet that I've encountered only a few times here and there, but have admired greatly. And it's a poem that I want to read a poem for Terry Tempest Williams called The Bear. In late winter, I sometimes glimpse bits of steam coming up from some fault in the old snow, and bend close and see it is lung-colored, and put down my nose and know the chilly, enduring odor of bear. I take a wolf's rib and whittle it sharp at both ends and coil it up and freeze it in blubber and place it out on the fairway of the bears. And when it has vanished, I move out on the bear tracks, roaming in circles until I come to the first tentative dark splash on the earth. And I set out running, following the splashes of blood wandering over the world. At the cut, gashed resting places, I stop and rest. At the crawl marks where he lay out on his belly to overpass some stretch of botchy ice, I lie out, dragging myself forward with bear knives in my fists. On the third day, I begin to starve. At nightfall, I bend down, as I knew I would, at a turd sopped in blood, and hesitate, and pick it up, and thrust it in my mouth, and gnash it down, and rise, and go on running. On the seventh day, living by now on bear blood alone, I can see his upturned carcass far out ahead, a scraggled, steamy hulk, the heavy fur riffling in the wind. I come up to him and stare at the narrow, spaced, petty eyes, the dismayed face laid back on a shoulder, the nostrils flared, catching perhaps the first taint of me as he died. I hack a ravine in his thigh and eat and drink and tear him down his whole length and open him and climb in and close him up after me against the wind. And sleep and dream of lumbering flat-footed over the tundra, stabbed twice from within, splattering a trail behind me, splattering it out to no matter which way I lurch, no matter which parabola of bare transcendence, which dance of solitude I attempt, which gravity-clutched leap, which trudge, which groan. Until one day I totter and fall on this stomach that has tried so hard to keep up, to digest the blood as it leaked in, to break up and digest the bone itself. And now the breeze blows over me, blows off the hideous belches of ill-digested bear blood and rotted stomach, and the ordinary wretched odor of bear blows across my sore, lolled tongue a song, or screech, until I think I must rise up and dance, and I lie still. I awaken, I think. Marsh lights reappear. Geese come trailing again up the flyway. In her ravine under old snow, the dam bear lies, licking lumps of smeared fur and drizzly eyes into shapes with her tongue. And one hairy-souled trudge stuck out before me. The next groaned out, the next. The rest of my days I spend wandering, wondering what anyway was that sticky infusion, that rank flavor of blood, that poetry by which I lived. There's a little poem about taking the bottle of milk required by our son Fergus when he would wake up in the middle of the night at age one. We were living in Mallorca, and that was very, very cold that winter. And He wouldn't take the milk unless he had a nice roaring fire to sit by while drinking the milk. And the thing was that the only wood you could make, they could use for firewood, was that of old, no longer bearing olive trees, which was extremely hard to get lighted. So I spent most of my nights getting those fires going, and then parts of them giving him the milk, and then parts of them just sitting there with him till he fell asleep. And they are among the most wonderful moments of my life. But of course, this was during the Vietnam War, so everything outside the room wasn't so rosy. When Fergus woke crying at night, I would carry him from his crib to the rocking chair and sit holding him before the fire of thousand-year-old olive wood. Sometimes, for reasons I never knew, and he has forgotten, even after his bottle, the big tears would keep on rolling down his big cheeks, the left cheek always more brilliant than the right, and we would sit, some nights for hours, rocking in the light, eking itself out of the ancient wood, and hold each other against the darkness, his close behind and far away in the future, mine, I imagined, all around. One such time, fallen half asleep myself, I thought I heard a scream, a flyer crying out in horror as he dropped fire on he didn't know what or whom, or else a child thus set aflame and sat up alert. The olive wood fire had burned low. In my arms lay Fergus, fast asleep, left cheek glowing. God. Now, I'm sure that all of you know about Breadloaf. I mean, about the kind of similar institution, the writer's colony at Peterborough, New Hampshire. What? McDowell. Oh, yeah, sure, the McDowell colony. Sorry. Yeah. where I've been a number of times, and there you have a cabin set off by itself in the woods, and generally people gather for breakfast and then for dinner, but the rest of the time work in the woods. And to get more done, I never turned up for breakfast, but I made oatmeal in my room. And one time a painter said, "How come we never see you at breakfast?" And I said, "I eat oatmeal in my room." And he looked at me with surprise and alarm, I thought. And he said, "Alone?" And I never knew what he meant by his question. But I thought about it. And the next morning, after making my oatmeal and eating it, I wrote "Oatmeal." I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone. I'm aware it is not good to eat oatmeal alone. Its consistency is such that it is better for your mental health if somebody eats it with you. That is why I often think up an imaginary companion to have breakfast with. Possibly it is even worse to eat oatmeal with an imaginary companion. Nevertheless, yesterday morning I ate my oatmeal with John Keats. Keats said I was right to invite him. Due to its glutinous texture, gluey lumpishness, hint of slime, and unusual willingness to disintegrate, oatmeal must never be eaten alone. He said it's perfectly okay, however, to eat it with an imaginary companion, and he himself had enjoyed memorable porridges with Edmund Spenser and John Milton. He also told me about writing the Ode to a Nightingale. He wrote it quickly, he said, on scraps of paper, which he then stuck in his pocket, but when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas, and he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift between stanzas, and the way here and there a line will go into the configuration of a Muslim at prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, then lay itself down slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with God's reckless wobble. He said that someone told him that later in life, Wordsworth heard about the scraps of paper on the table and tried shuffling some stanzas of his own, but only made matters worse. When breakfast was over, John recited "To Autumn." He recited it slowly with much feeling, and he articulated the words lovingly, and his odd accent sounded sweet. He didn't offer the story of writing "To Autumn." I doubt if there is much of one, but he did say the sight of a just harvested oat field got him started on it. And two of the lines, "For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells," and "Thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours," came to him while eating oatmeal alone. I can see him drawing a spoon through the stuff, gazing into the glimmering furrows, muttering, and it occurs to me, maybe there is no sublime, only the shining of the amnion's tatters. For supper tonight, I'm going to have a baked potato left over from lunch. I'm aware that a leftover baked potato can be damp, slippery, and simultaneously gummy and crumbly, and therefore, I'm going to invite Patrick Kavanaugh to join me. Well, this is a poem called "Feathering," providing feathers for the birds in spring to line their nests with, particularly in this case, the tree swallows. Feathering. Many heads before mine have waked in the dark on that old pillow and lain there, awake, wondering at the strangeness within themselves they had been a part of a moment ago. She has ripped out the stitches at one end and stands on the stone table in the garden holding the pillow like a sack and plunges her fingers in and extracts a thick handful of breast feathers. A few of the feathers snow toward the ground and immediately tree swallows appear. She raises the arm holding the down straight up in the air and stands there like a mom at a school crossing or a god of seed time about to release a stream of bits of plenitude, or herself long ago at a pond, chumming for sunfish with breadcrumbs. At the lift of a breeze, her fist loosens and parcels out a slow upward tumble of dozens of puffs, near zero on the scale of materiality. More swallows loop and dive about her. Now with a flap, one picks up speed and streaks in at a feather, misses, twists on itself and streaks back, and this time snaps its beak shut on it and soars and banks back to where its nest box is. A few more flurries, and she ties off the pillow, ending for today the game they make of it when she's there, the imperative to feather one's nest come down from the Pliocene. At the window, where I've been watching through bird glasses, I can see a graceful awkwardness in her walk, as if she's tipsy or not sure where she's been, and yet is deeply happy. Sometimes when we're out at dinner and a dim mood from the day persists in me, she flies up and disappears and plucks out of the air somewhere this or that amusement or comfort, and back again lays it in our dinner talk. Once, when it was time to leave, she stood up and, scanning about the restaurant for the restroom, went up as if on tiptoe like the upland plover. In the taxi, we kissed a mint from the desk from my mouth to hers, like cedar waxwings. Later, when I padded up to bed, I found her dropped off, the bedside lamp still on, an open book face down over her heart. And though my plod had felt quiet, her eyes at once opened. And when I climbed into our bed and crept toward the side of it lined with the down comforter and the warmth and softness of herself, she took me in her arms and sang to me in high, soft, clear, wild notes. Well, I thought I would pause for a moment here, for a few minutes here, and ask if any of you have any question or you would like to ask or thought you would like to express or other kinds of utterance. Yes. Could you speak a little louder, please? Uh-huh. Under the Maud Moon. If I can fit it in, I will. Yes. Anybody else got a? No. All right. Well, that was quick. So, where are we here? So I better read Under the Maud Moon. Get that in. Okay. On the path by this wet site of old fires, black ashes, black stones, where tramps must have squatted down, gnawing on stream water, unhouseling themselves on cursed bread, failing to get warm at a twig fire, I stop, gather wet wood, cut dry shavings, and for her whose face I held in my hand a few hours, whom I gave back only to keep holding the space where she was, I light a small fire in the rain. The black wood reddens, the death watches inside begin running out of time. I can see the dead crossed limbs longing for the universe. I can hear in the wet wood the snap and re-snap of the same embrace being torn. The raindrops trying to put the fire out fall into it and are changed. The oath broken, the oath sworn between earth and water, flesh and spirit broken, to be sworn again over and over in the clouds and broken again over and over on earth. I sit a while by the fire in the rain, speak a few words into its warmth, stone, Saint Smooth Stone, and murmur one of the songs I used to croak to my daughter in her nightmares. Somewhere out ahead of me, a black bear sits alone on his hillside, nodding from side to side. He sniffs the blossom smells, the rained earth. Finally, he gets up, eats a few flowers, trudges away, all his fur glistening in the rain. The singed grease streams out of the words. The one held note remains, a love note, twisting under my tongue like the coyote's bark curving off into a howl. A round-cheeked girl child comes awake in her crib. The green swaddlings tear open, a filament or vestment tears, the blue flower opens, and she who is born, she who sings and cries, she who begins the passage, her hair sprouting out, her gums budding for her first spring on earth, the mist still clinging about her face, puts her hand into her mother's mouth to take hold of her song. It is all over, little one, the flipping and overleaping, the watery somersaulting alone in the oneness under the hill, under the old lonely belly button pushing forth again in remembrance, the drifting there furled in the dark, pressing a knee or elbow along a slippery wall, sculpting the world with each thrash, the stream of Omphalos blood humming all about you. Her head enters the head hole that starts sucking her forth. Existence closes down all over her, draws her into the shuddering grip of departure, the slow, agonized clenches making the last molds of her life in the dark. The black eye opens, the pupil druzed with black hairs stops, the chakra on top of the brain throbs a long moment in world light, and she skids out on her face into light, this peck of stunned flesh clotted with celestial cheesiness, glowing with the astral violet of the underlife. And as they cut her tie to the darkness, she dies a moment, turns blue as a coal, the limbs shaking as the memories rush out of them. And when they hang her up by the feet, she sucks air, screams her first song, and turns rose. When it was cold on our hillside and you cried in the crib rocking through the darkness on wood knifed down to the curve of the smile, a sadness stranger than ours, all of it turned back toward the other world. I used to come to you and sit by you and sing to you. You did not know, and yet you will remember in the silent zones of the brain, a specter, descendant of the ghostly forefathers, singing to you in the nighttime. Not the songs of light said to wave through the bright hair of angels, but a blacker rasping flowering on that tongue. For when the maud moon glimmered in those first nights, and the archer lay sucking the icy bistings of the cosmos in his crib of stars, I had crept down to riverbanks, their long rustle of being and perishing, down to marshes where the earth oozes up in cold streaks, touching the world with the underglimmer of the beginning, and there learned my only song. And in the days when you find yourself orphaned, emptied of wind singing, of light, the pieces of cursed bread on your tongue, may there come back to you a voice, spectral, calling you sister from everything that dies, and then you shall open this book, even if it is the book of nightmares.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
All right. Who would have thought that Johnny Cash, that Galway Canal opened for Johnny Cash that night?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
it was amazing.
Yeah. Must have been quite an evening at Red Loaf.
Well, it just seemed like the right song to play.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good one.
You're listening to Wordplay. This is Sebastian Matthews and Jeff Davis on a Sunday having a good time here. WPVM.
Indeed. 103.5 on your old radio dial or on the web at
WPVM.org.
O-R-G. Right.
Well, we wanted to just take a few minutes here and plug and talk about, exude enthusiasm for WordFest. April 24th, coming up this month, through the 27th. That's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
All through Asheville and beyond, Marshall as well.
That's right.
Galway Canal is one of our headliners.
Right.
Along with Patricia Smith, Simon Ortiz, Coleman Barks, Kay Byer, the North Carolina Poet Laureate.
Right.
Fatima Keshavarz, I think is how she pronounces
Keshavarz, right. She's going to be reading with Galway Canal.
Yes, and she's a renowned translator of Rumi, as is Coleman Barks.
As is Coleman Barks, I know.
So you got the schedule there. What, can you give us a brief rundown?
Yeah, sure. Just to hit on main events, Patricia Smith, who's a really wonderful performance poet, is going to be opening with Rick Chess at UNCA on April 24th at 7 o'clock.
And she was a national winner of the Slam,
right.
And
right.
A great page poet as well.
Right. Yeah, you can actually read Patricia Smith with pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the following evening, again at 7 o'clock at UNCA at the Humanities Lecture Hall, Simon Ortiz, Mary Jo Moore, and Catherine Stripling Byer,
yes,
our very own, will be reading. And then on 10 o'clock after that,
yeah,
Glynis Redmond, Alan Wolfe, Jim Nave, and Laura Hope Gill, our former co-host,
yep,
will be at Malaprops talking about the days of the Green Door.
Yeah, and reading too, hopefully.
And reading too, yeah, of course. That, right, right.
That's a real nice connection to the first poetry festival in town and all the great stuff going on.
Right, right.
And then
right.
Later the next day on Saturday at 2 o'clock, Coleman Barks will be reading at the Fine Arts Cinema, at the Fine Arts Theater. All of this is free, by the way.
Yeah.
And he'll be, and then at 4 o'clock, we'll all meet, all of us who have been reading and listening and hanging out and playing music, will be coming together at Malaprops at 4 for a book signing and just a reception. There is so much more. Alan Wolfe will be reading at the Children's Poetry, at the Spellbound Children's Bookstore later, Saturday morning at 11. All of this will be on the website, AshevilleWordFest.org, and you can check that out. We're connected also to the Writing Salon, which has been, it will be doing a week-long intensive workshop the week before, April 21st to the 25th, and they are at thewritingsalon.net. You can look into that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a bunch of local events coming up. Also, at the end of the whole weekend, I mean, WordFest local. A bunch of poets, Jeff and David Hopes and Rose McLarney and Gary Copeland Lilly and Alan Wolf and Keith Flynn and Leanne Brown are all reading at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center that last night on Sunday at 7. But earlier in the day...
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah. The thing that Leanne is doing with Devin Johnson of Flood Editions and Kathy Wagner.
Oh, yeah. That's also at the center, yeah.
That's also at the center at the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center on, over on Broadway. And that's at 2 o'clock. So that's actually, you'll have to miss wordplay that day, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're... Yes,
we're just going to put on something.
We'll put on something.
Johnny Cash.
Right. It'll be the all music, you know, Wordfest or Wordplay. Yeah. The Wordfest edition of Wordplay. So, yeah, that's going to be really interesting. A look at the Black Mountain College legacy. Yeah. So,
And that 2 o'clock reading is at the Flood Gallery. We're excited to be working with them.
Yeah.
Mark Podowski. But also we're going to be connecting with Graham Hackett at Bobo Gallery late night Saturday at 10 o'clock, going to probably till midnight or more with the younger scene.
Right. And then Leanne and Tony are having their thing out in Marshall, too, which is going to be an
11 p.m. on all night.
Right.
Wordfest Dream Theater. So lots going on. The website, the posters are going up. You'll be seeing them around town. We'll be getting some good advertising in local papers and hopefully mentioned on the radio like this. So
And, of course, we'll be barraging you with emails.
Yeah. That's my favorite tactic.
Yes. And speaking of email, you know, we now have an email address so that people can actually drop us a note, and that's wordplayradio@gmail.com.
Great. So, I might even respond.
Yeah, that's right. We both get them. So, yeah, there's a chance we might even write back. You never know.
All right. Well, we thought we'd go back to that night at Bread Loaf and some... beautiful August evening, to the last part of the reading of Galway Canal, which is, this is about a year, almost a year after 9/11, and he read his famous, and I think also infamous in some ways.
It was controversial.
Put in the New Yorker. And I remember I was at that reading, people were excited and really angry at that poem, as if it was too early or too direct or not the right response. But at the same time, as a poet, as an elder, as a witness, you know, that was his response.
And it's amazing, you know, as it really, looking back now on that whole era, you know, here we are, 7 years on down the road almost. And for such an immediate response, it's so balanced. I mean, it's so, in a way, not caught up in the frenzy of, you know, of response to 9/11. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
It's compassionate. And it's got a real vision.
Yeah, so. It's called Towers Fall.
Yeah.
And if I can make this work, I'm going to start with actually the night before, a young poet named Maria Hummel opened her reading by, I think in the same spirit, but didn't say anything about it, just recited off the top of her head a great Whitman poem. And I have that on cassette. And if I can get it to play, I'm just going to play that.
Let's try that.
If it doesn't work, there'll be an awkward pause, which we'll cut out later.
Right.
And then we...
You podcasters won't hear it.
Yeah, social realism at its best. And then we'll go into the Galway Canal, both at Bread Loaf Writers Conference in August of 2002.
A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing its owner's name some way in the corners so that we may see and remark and say whose. Or I guess the grass itself is a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white, Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff. I give them the same, I receive the same, and now it seems to me the beautiful, uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you come from old people and from women and from offspring taken soon out of their laps. And here you are, the mother's laps. The grass is very dark to come from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to have come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, then the hints about the old men and mothers and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? What do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and cease the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different than what anyone supposed, and luckier.
Nice.
Maria Hummel.
Maria Hummel.
Good poet, good writer.
Right. Reading Whitman, yeah. Yeah, you know, we ought to mention that one of the primary sponsors for our upcoming WordFest is also the same organization that brings you Wordplay.
Yeah.
Because it sponsors... WPVM.org, and that's Maine, of course, Mountain Area Information Network. If you need internet service, they're a good choice. They're working to increase the speed of their broadband network downtown, and they're all about keeping media free, keeping media open, and not in the hands of corporate
And some of the things that this WordFest really embodies or tries to put forth is an idea of poetry uniting people, poetry as a kind of journalism.
Right.
All inclusiveness, all voices being heard, community-based, international at the same time. You know,
right.
All these things Maine is doing as a media outreach project. And in a sense, we're collaborating with them as a project.
Yeah.
And there'll be their TV... what's the TV station? I'm forgetting, but there will be... Mm-hmm. They'll be putting it on their
on the public access channel.
Yeah. We'll be putting it on here.
URTV.
URTV. And there will also be some chances for us to bring it out to the schools. So thanks to them and to Wally. And it's an exciting collaboration.
It is. Yeah.
All right. Back to Breadloaf, up in the mountains, getting kind of cold. And this is Galway Canal.
Now I'm going to read a poem, another longish poem. Called Towers Falling, that I've been working on for almost a month short of a year. And there are a number of poems quoted in my poem, one by Francois Villon, one by Hart Crane, and one by Paul Celan, and one by Alexandre Bott, and one by Whitman. And I'm happy that I have three helpers here who will read the other languages. Raja Sadarat will read French, and Jenna Kalinsky will read the German, and Katarzyna Gwiazda will read the Polish. And the New Yorker, if you had had an introducer here, I would ask the introducer to say this, but the New Yorker requires me to say that this poem will be published in the New Yorker in September. They feel, you know, I'm not allowed to publish this poem until a month after their publication, and they seem to think that, well, correctly think that reading aloud is a form of publication, and so this is a kind of a permission stipulation. Okay. So I'll start. Towers Falling. From our high window, we saw the towers with their bands and blocks of light brighten against a fading sunset. Saw them at any hour glitter and live, as if the spirits inside them sat up all night calculating profit and loss. Saw them reach up to steep their tops in the until then invisible yellow of sunrise. Grew so used to them, often we didn't see them. And now, not seeing them, we see them. The CEO is talking to London. Umberto is delivering breakfast sandwiches. The trader is already working the phone. The mail sorter has started sorting the mail.
Pauvre et riche.
Poor and rich.
Sage et fou. Restre et laid.
Wise and foolish priest and layman.
Noble, vilain, large et chiche.
Nobleman, serfs, generous and mean.
Petits et ronds et beaux et laid.
Short and tall and handsome and homely. The plane screamed low down lower Fifth Avenue, lifted at the arch, someone said, shaking the dog walkers in Washington Square Park, drove for the target, struck with a heavy thud and bright gush of blackened iron, orange fire, and vanished, leaving a hole the size and shape a cartoon plane might make, as if it had passed harmlessly through and were flying away now on the far side, back into the realm of the imaginary. Some with torn clothes, some bloodied, some limping at top speed like children in a three-legged race, some half-dragged, some intact in neat suits and dresses. They straggle out of step up the avenues, everyone dusted to a ghostly whiteness, all eyes rubbed red as the eyes of a Zahoris who can see the dead under the ground. Some died while calling home to say they were okay. Some died after over an hour spent learning they would die. Some died so abruptly they may have seen death from within it. Some broke windows and leaned out, waiting for rescue. Some were asphyxiated. Some burned, their very faces caught fire. Some fell, letting gravity speed them through their terrible moment. Some leapt hand in hand, the elasticity in the last scraps of love time, perhaps letting their vertical streaks down the sky happen more lightly. At the high window where I've often stood to escape a nightmare, I meet the unblinking single eye, lighting the all-night, lifting and sifting for bodies, bits of bodies, anything that is not nothing, in an ancient search that always goes on somewhere, now in New York and Kabul. She walks the streets, holding up a photograph of her husband. He is smiling. In the wind shift, misting broom, few pass, sorry, sorry, sorry. She startles as if thinking she almost sees him. Suppose over there that headlong lope, or up the street that hair so black it's purple. Suppose some evening I forgot the fare and transfer, yet got by that way without recall, lost yet poised in traffic, then might I find your eyes. Could happen. Sorry, sorry, good luck, thank you. On this side, it is amnesia, or forgetting the way home. On the other, invisibleness, or never entirely returning. Hard to see in the metallic mist, or through the sheet of mock reality cast over our world, born that no creature ever born pokes its way back through, and no love can tear. The towers burn and fall. Burn and fall, resembling in a shot from New Jersey, smokestacks spewing oily earth remnants out of the past.
Schwarze Milch, der Frühe, wir trinken sie abends.
Black milk of daybreak, we drink it at evening.
Wir trinken sie Mittage und morgens, wir trinken sie nachts.
We drink it at midday, at morning, we drink it at night.
Wir trinken und trinken.
We drink it and drink it. This is not a comparison, but a corollary, not a likeness, but a common lineage in the modern history of suffering and violent death. Black men in the South castrated and strung up from trees. Soldiers advancing through mud at 90,000 dead per mile. Train upon train headed eastward, made up of boxcars shoved full to the corners with Jews and gypsies to be gassed. State murder of 20, 30, 40 million of its own. Atomic blasts wiping cities off the earth. Fire bombings the same. Death marches, starvations, disappearances, assassinations. Entire countries turned into rubble, minefields, mass graves. Seeing the towers vomit these black omens that the last century dumped into this one for us to dispose of, we know they are our futures. That is our own black milk crossing the sky.
Wir schäufeln ein Graben den Luften, da liegt man nicht eng.
We're digging a grave in the sky. There'll be plenty of room to lie down there. Burst jet fuel, incinerated aluminum, steel fume, pulverized drywall, disintegrated marble, exploded granite, mashed concrete, berserked plastics, gasified mercury, cracked chemicals, scoria, vapor of the vaporized, wafted here from the burnings of the past, draped over our island up to streets regimented into numbers and letters, breathed across the great bridges to Brooklyn and the waiting sea, astringent, miasmic, empyromatic, sticky, reek too toxic to take in, but we take it in, too gruesome for seekers of the amnesiac lost to breathe, but they breathe it and you breathe it. Her photograph hangs from a string at his neck. He stands looking down at the sidewalk of flagstone slabs. He stands looking down at the sidewalk of flagstone slabs laid down in Whitman's century, edges rasped by iron wheels to a melted roundedness, a conscious mind envying the stones.
Nie stają się, są.
They do not become. They are.
Nic nad to, myślałem.
Nothing but that, I thought.
Zbrzydziwszy sobie.
Having made loathsome to myself.
Wszystko, co staje się.
Everything that becomes. And I sat down by the waters of the Hudson, by the North Cove yacht basin, and thought of how those on the high floors must have suffered, knowing they would burn alive, and then burning alive. And I wondered, are there ways of dying so terrible, so mutilating of existence itself, that no one, not even the dead, ever fully gets over it? And then I saw in steel letters welded to the railing posts Walt Whitman's words, written when America plunged into war with itself. City of the world, proud and passionate city, mettlesome, mad, extravagant city. Words of that time of illusions. And then I remembered his words of years later, when the war was long over and Lincoln dead. The white skeletons of young men, I saw them. I saw the debris and debris of all the dead soldiers of the war. But I saw they were not as was thought. They themselves were fully at rest. They suffered not. The living remained and suffered, the mother suffered, and the wife and the child and the musing comrade suffered. In our minds, the glassy blocks succumb over and over into themselves, slam down floor by floor into themselves. They blow up in reverse, exploding downward and outward, billowing through the streets, engulfing the fleeing. As each tower goes down, it concentrates into itself, transforms itself infinitely slowly into a black hole infinitesimally small, space without mass, where each light, each life put out, lies down within us. And I'm going to close by just a little passage here that picks up on a passage from the Under the Maud Moon that I've read already. A black bear sits alone in the twilight, nodding from side to side, turning slowly around and around on himself, scuffing the four-footed circle into the earth. He sniffs the sweat in the breeze. He understands a creature, a death creature, watches from the fringe of the trees. Finally, he understands, I am no longer here. He himself, from the fringe of the trees, watches a black bear get up, eat a few flowers, trudge away, all his fur glistening in the rain. And what glistening? Sancho Fergus, my boy child, had such great shoulders. When he was born, his head came out, the rest of him stuck, and he opened his eyes, his head out there all alone in the room. He squinted with pained, barely unglued eyes at the ninth month's blood splashing beneath him on the floor, and almost smiled, I thought, almost forgave it all in advance. And when he came wholly forth, I took him up in my hands and bent over and smelled the black glistening fur of his head, as empty space must have bent over the newborn planet and smelled the grasslands and the ferns. Thank you.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I walk for miles along the highway. Well, that's just my way of saying I love you. I'm always walking after midnight.
Right. That was Galway Canal, Red Loaf Writers Conference 2002.
Yeah. Nice reading. Nice reading.
I like
the
way you brought, I forgot about that, the bear poem back around.
At the end. I'd forgotten that as well. Yeah. Well, good. This has been another fun afternoon of poetry here on WordFest. We're brought to you by WPVM 103.5, produced in the studios of WPVM 103.5 in downtown Asheville. You can catch us on the web sometimes at wordplayradio.blogspot.com. We occasionally do update that once in a while. And also, I'll post to the station website as well, which is wpvm.org. We're available 24/7 by live, on-demand stream and podcast from the archive page for the week after the show. So if you want to catch this again later, or if you're one of our podcast listeners, it'll be there.
We hope.
We hope, if all goes well.
And is next week our spring fundraiser?
It is the spring fundraiser from the 11th to the 18th. And so we'll be...
WPVM will be talking to you.
Talking to you about raising money for the upcoming summer. This is our, you know, we do them twice a year, so... Hopefully we'll raise enough money to make it till the next time. So,
I think so. All right. See you later. We're making way.